The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words. And this program comes to you from the Commonwealth Institute. And those taking part are Anne Scott-James, Dillis Powell, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norden. Here's round one to test their vocabulary. 2 marks if they can get the meaning of these words approximately right. Beginning with Anne Scott-James. Anne, what is a or an, and I'm never quite certain which, what is a ewer, E-W-E-R?
Oh, those lovely old-fashioned washstands that one gets in country pubs. Inns, I mean. It's the basin part. The jug part.
That's better.
The jug part of a jug and basin.
That's right. 2 marks, well done.
You notice that in the Commonwealth Institute, Jack will ask, what is a ewer? But in the pub round the corner, he never says, what's yours?
I'm glad this question was in the singular.
There's a song about it.
There must be.
Night and day, you were the one.
All right, on to Frank Muir. And yours is rather harder, I think, Frank.
Okay.
What is or was a Clarence?
A what?
A Clarence.
Clarence?
When I was young, it was sometimes called a mother's boy. But it's also a carriage.
Yes.
Early Victorian, and a town carriage.
Yes.
I'll give you and a horse in front.
All right, I think that's good enough. It's a four-wheeled, closed carriage with seats for four inside and two outside on the box, and it was named after the Duke of Clarence, who afterwards became the Sailor King William IV. 2 marks, well done. Dennis Powell, what is a clavicle?
A bone.
Yes, which one?
Collarbone.
Absolutely right, 2 marks it is. Dennis Norden, what is a heptad?
Well, hep... Yes, it could be a rather sort of switched-on tadpole. Or hep means seven. It couldn't conceivably be a seven-sided tadpole. There wouldn't be room in the pond.
Stick to the seven idea, that's all right.
But it's something seven. Something, a group of seven.
Yes, hello. That's good. Yes, well done.
Oh.
It's a set or a group of seven. What was that film? There's a film about them. Seven.
The Magnificent Seven.
The Magnificent Seven. That would be a heptad. The Greek for seven. Well, before we start round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and the two women members of the team will, I hope, go on studying those quotations during the program, because at the end, I shall ask them the source of the two quotations. Anne Scott-James and Dennis Norden, first of all, your quotation is, let them eat cake. And Dillis Powell and Frank Muir, your quotation is, you left behind a broken doll. And at the end of the program, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their idea of how these came to be said or written. And so to the second round, which is about classical mythology. Mm. 2 marks, if you get the answers reasonably right. Beginning with Anne Scott-James. Anne, who was Nemesis?
Well, Nemesis was fate which overtook you inescapably and unavoidably.
Not quite, Anne. I mean, it contains that idea.
Retribution.
That's it.
For whatever you had done.
Not whatever you had done. No. Suppose you're a king. Or a queen.
Nemesis was the ace.
That's just about it.
I thought it was retribution for your sins.
Yes.
Why does a king get more affected by nemesis than anybody else?
Well, you were A, fortunate, and if you were particularly arrogant or cocky...
You mean it's the result of hubris?
It's the result of hubris. Yeah, if you were like that, then Nemesis came and sorted you out pretty rapidly. And so that Nemesis, as a goddess, both in Greece and in Rome, was divine retributive justice coming and sorting you out afterwards. 2 marks. No. Who was Boreas? B-O-R-E-A-S. Boreas.
What do you...
Wind.
We think North yes. Wind.
What you both think is absolutely dead right. Boreas was the North Wind, a god who was the son of Astrea, and his brothers were the other winds, and he was said to have helped the Athenians in their war against the Persians by blowing very hard and destroying the Persian fleet.
Oh, I remember that.
Now, Dillis Powell. Dillis, who was Aesculapius or Asclepius?
Aesculapius was a kind of semi-divine character who was concerned with medicine.
Yes. And became, after being semi-divine...
Well, he became really divine.
Yes, and then became the god
of healing.
Yes, absolutely right. 2 marks it is. He was a Greek god to start with, son of Apollo, and you sacrificed to him when you recovered, if you did recover, which is rather rarely, and you sacrificed a cock to Aesculapius, hence the phrase. He also is usually pictured with a serpent, because he once went and saved the Romans when they had a frightful plague, and he appeared, rather unusually, in the shape of a serpent, hence the badge of the Royal Army Medical Corps. Dennis Norden, who was Cassiopeia?
I haven't the faintest idea.
Well, somebody or other set her up in the heavens, didn't
yes,
they?
Right.
It was a constellation of Cassiopeia.
Yes.
I think she fell into the sea, was picked up and put into the sky.
I can
We're
make
going
you,
too fast,
I
me.
Can make you a star, he said.
One out of two for partial accuracy and sheer ingenuity. She was the wife of Cepheus, who was king of Ethiopia, and she was the beautiful mother of a girl called Andromeda, and the mum, Cassiopeia, boasted that she was as beautiful as the sea nymphs, and that made Neptune or Poseidon very cross, and he sent a sea monster, and the only way to get rid of the sea monster, which ate everybody, was to sacrifice the daughter Andromeda to the sea monster. But she was saved at the last moment by Perseus. And then both of them were put, and here they're quite right, up into the sky as constellations. One Andromeda, and the other one Cassiopeia. One out of two. Well, the next round is verse and poetry. I give each member of each team a quotation and ask them for the following line or lines. 2 marks if they can finish off the quotation, and 2 more if they can name the author, the poem it comes from. Beginning with Anne Scott James. Oh, where and oh, where is your Highland laddie gone?
And Dennis, you know I can never do the quotations.
I kept missing where oh, where's my little
doggy gone?
Gone. It's, and the next line is, where,
oh, well, where
can
he
be?
This will do just as well for this. With his ears cut short and his tail cut long, where is that Scots laddie wee?
He went to fight the French.
That's it. It's the Blue Bells of Scotland.
Oh, yeah.
Author Dorothea Jordan, and as she didn't live until 1762 and died in the 19th century, I think she's talking about fighting the French sort of later on. Where and oh, where is your Highland laddie gone? He's gone to fight the French for King George upon the throne. And it's, oh, in my heart, how I wish him safe at home. Frank Muir. Pussy said to the owl, you elegant fowl, how charmingly sweet you sing. Oh, let us be married. Too long have we tarried, but what shall we do for a ring?
And they sailed away for a year and a day to the land where the bung trees grow.
Yes.
And there in a wood a piggy wig stood. With a ring on the end of his nose, with a ring on the end of his nose.
Well done. Title and author?
Lear.
Yes?
The owl and the, pussycat.
Well done. 4 marks. Now, Dillis Powell. Oh, what a fall was there, my countrymen. Then I and you and all of us fell down whilst bloody treason flourished over us.
Well, it's Shakespeare.
Yeah.
William.
Mm-hmm.
The Havoc Cry.
It's a Havoc Cry, yes.
Yeah.
It's Julius Caesar.
Yes, quite right.
It's Mark Antony's speech over the body of Julius Caesar.
Yes. Oh, what a fall was there, my countrymen. Then I and you and all of us fell down whilst bloody treason flourished over us. Oh, now you weep, and I perceive you feel the dint of pity. These are gracious drops. 2 marks. Dennis Norden, Ah, make the most of what we yet may spend before we too into the dust descend.
Dowson, is it something like an unfamiliar Ernest Dowson poem?
Lots of cups and wines and things.
Could you say
it again?
Or
is it Khayyam? Is it Omar Khayyam?
Yes.
Well, it's Omar Khayyam, yeah.
By?
Fitzgerald.
Yes.
I don't know how it ends.
Two out of four, then. Edward Fitzgerald's translation, Omar Khayyam, first version. I'll make the most of what we yet may spend before we too into the dust descend. Dust into dust and under dust to lie. Sans wine, sans song, sans singer, and sans end. Well, then we have a round of origins and derivations. 3 marks, possible, if members of the team can first of all get the present meaning of these phrases or words right, and then give the origin and derivation. Beginning with Anne Scott James again. Anne, what does utopia mean, and how did it originate?
It means a heavenly or ideal place.
Yes.
And it originates from it's the title of Moore's book.
Yeah.
When he wrote about the same said ideal place.
Yes. Which Moore?
Thomas.
Yes, that's all right. 3 marks it is. Frank Miller. To leave no stone unturned.
It means to explore every avenue. It's a great little politician's phrase, this, isn't it?
Well, fair enough.
It means that you'll use every endeavour to arrive at the truth or the information that you want.
And it's alleged to come from a particular incident a long time ago. I wonder if you know what it is.
Burke and Hare. The resurrectionists. Burke smothered them, Hare dug them up. And they left no gravestone unturned. Or was it... how long ago was it?
Oh, 3,000... No, 2,500 years ago.
I think it was Pericles.
It's earlier than Pericles.
Earlier than Pericles. Mythological character.
No.
No, not a mythological.
No, it's historical.
No, I don't.
1.5, I think, out of 3. And, as Frank Miller says, it means to be extremely thorough in what you're trying to do. But there was a great battle between the Greeks and the Persians at Plataea, and the Persian Mardonius, who was defeated, was supposed to have left an awful lot of treasure in or around his tent. And the victor, the Greek Polycrates, wanted, naturally, to find this treasure, couldn't find it, consulted the oracle at Delphi, and the oracle said, leave no stone unturned. So he sent all his men digging all over the battlefield and found the treasure, and it's a happy story, and that's the ending. 1.5. Dearest Bar, to cast pearls before swine.
Well, it means to lavish something good on something on people who don't deserve it.
Yes. And origin?
The Bible.
I think it is.
The Bible.
Yes. Giving something good to somebody who's incapable of appreciating it. It's in St. Matthew's Gospel. Give not that which is holy unto the dogs, neither cast your pearls before swine, lest haply they trample them under their feet and turn and rend you. Now, Dennis Norden, your word is bakshi. B-U-C-K-S-H-E-E. It's usually spelled that way. Bakshi.
It means free.
Yes.
For nothing. Bakshi. Sounds like an effeminate male rabbit. I should think it's
a bit of a Clarence.
Yeah. It's Indian or something. It sounds like a troops word.
Yes, it is.
It's Indian or Arabian or something that the troops brought back.
Yes, it comes from an Indian word, and one again which is fairly familiar.
Bakshish. Yes. Bakshish.
Yes, that's it.
Bakshish.
Three marks we get. And now we come to the last round and go back to the quotations I gave the two teams earlier in the program. For 2 marks, Anne Scott James, can you give me the origin of your quotation? Let them eat cake.
Well, it's always attributed to Marie Antoinette.
And why did she do it?
Well, because she was told that the poor of Paris had no bread, so she said, rather foolishly, well, let them eat cake.
Yes, absolutely right. It may have been used earlier in history, but it's normally attributed to Marie Antoinette, the wife of Louis XVI, some little time before they both lost their heads. 2 marks. Now, Dillis Powell, the origin of your quotation, which was, You left behind a broken doll.
Well, it was a song very popular a long time ago. I should say in about the time of the First War.
I think 1.5. It's a Victorian song by Clifford Harris, and the title is You Called Me Baby Doll a Year Ago. Well, now I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanations of how these quotations came into being, and on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation gets the longer amount of applause from the audience here in the theatre. So, back, first of all, to Dennis Norden with his quotation, Let Them Eat Cake.
Well, she didn't say this. Marie Antoinette. She wasn't that kind of a girl. I actually had a cousin who looked terribly like Marie Antoinette. So much like it, he had to leave his job in the end. I never did believe she said anything as nasty as this, and I got confirmation of it when I bought in the Portobello Road a writing desk of the time of Louis XVI for 35 bob. Which isn't bad for Louis XVI, is it? It works out just over 2 bob a Louis, actually, if you work it out. And in this writing desk was a drawer. And in the drawer was a diary in Marie Antoinette's own hand. I don't know how she got the hand into the drawer, but I've had that trouble sometimes. And in this diary gave the actual facts of what happened on that momentous evening when she's said to have said this. That evening, they were having people to dinner, her and Louis, you know. And she had ordered an ox to be roasted whole for dinner, because it gives a meal man appeal, you know. And she was in the kitchen while it was cooking, and, you know, she was just sort of doing the last minute things to it, taking the harness off and sort of chopping away the cart, you know, and things like that. And she was just reaching for a 16-gallon drum, because there's an awful lot of gravy, you see, with a with an ox, when who should rush in but Louis himself? And he said, Après moi, le déluge, which is French expression meaning the shower is after me, you see. And she said, What do you mean? And he said, the poor people of Paris. At that moment, a stone crashed through the window, and outside there was this mob muttering, you know, Danton, Marat. They were out there shaking their fists and muttering French epithets, like, give us some epithet bread. Come out, you fat epithet, you see. And she said, what is the matter with them? And he said, they have no bread. So she said, you mean they're starving? And he said, yes. At which, instead of uttering this awful sick joke, which history has reputed to her, she cut down the ox and gave them her own supper. She pushed forward the royal wheelbarrow and said to the bewildered Louis, not let them eat cake, but, and this was, of course, he couldn't hear properly because of this crowd muttering, you know, liberté, galité, and epithet fraternité, you know. What she actually said to him was, load the meat, cock.
Well, now all the European history books will have to be rewritten, and before they do that, we'll go back to Frank Muir and his quotation. You left behind a broken doll.
I was the victim of a schizophrenic tattooist. And that's why I lost the overdraft at the bank. And why, whenever I have to fill up one of those questionnaires you get from the council or for a passport or something, I have to write there, you left behind a broken doll. It really is infuriating. What happened was, it was some time ago, and I wanted to speak to my bank manager about getting some money out of him, what is humorously called a personal loan. Now, to do this, I obviously had to impress him that I was a solid citizen. So I put on my sincerest dark blue suit, a sober tie, a pair of mid-blue socks. Those are important. Note that. Mid-blue socks and a pair of black shoes lightly buffed. And I made my way to the bank just before lunch. Plenty of time, you see. Unhappily, on the way there, on the bus, I was bitten by a bird, by a rather annoyed canary. The lady next to me had this canary in a cage, and it obviously objected to my lightly buffed black shoes being near it. It was right on the floor next to them, and this canary bit me in the ankle. I yelped a little, as one does when one is bitten in the ankle by a canary, but the canary had made a small hole in my left sock. And as I got off the bus and walked towards the bank, I felt my left heel being a little drafty. And I looked down, and of course my mid-blue-coloured socks, which were wool, had now got a sizable hole in them, the left one, about the size of half a crown. Now, you cannot pretend to your bank manager that you are a sober, respectable citizen, standing there in your sincere suit, and a dirty great hole in your left sock. What to do? I thought a good deal about this problem, quite naturally. Then I realized that the only sensible solution would be to have that particular part of my heel tattooed blue. So I went into a phone box and got a classified telephone directory and found there was a tattooist called Fred Merrylove who lived in the East India Dock Road. I found this tattooist and entered, a very nice man, elderly, rather a sort of staring look in his eye. He said, "Oh, sir, I'm so glad to see you. Customs kind of dropped off with the tattooing trade. I don't think I've had tattoos since 1922. So he said, "Now, what can I do for you, sir?" "Oh, sir, kind sir, I can do you the Beatles, of whom you have no doubt heard, sir. I can do you Paul McCartney or Bingo. I could do a speaking likeness of each." I said, "No, thank you." He said, "I can do comedians. I can do Ken Dodd." I said, "No, thank you. I want you to tattoo a small blue circle on my left ankle." It seemed to sort of chill him. He went sort of white, and then he said, "You're the first customer I've had, sir, for the last 18 years. I had hoped that I could do something on you worthy of my needlecraft. But this," a strange gleam came in his eye, he said, "proffer me your ankle, sir." And dipping a needle thing with a little wooden handle into some rather glungy blue stuff, he jabbed it with full force into my left ankle. I fainted away. I fainted clean away. When I came to, he said, "I'm so sorry, sir, you were a little disturbed, but I'm sure you'll find my work very satisfactory." It was a rather worried Muir who made his way to the bank. But anyway, the hole didn't show in my sock. The blue looked exactly like the wool. And I sat down in the manager's chair. As I sat down on the manager's chair, I suddenly felt a little restless on the left side of where one normally sits down. A kind of prickly, burning sensation. It's rather squirming around, so I had to do a sort of tilt to the right during the interview. And this burning sensation on the left side of where a chap sits down got worse and worse until I was squirming all over the place. So, of course, the manager said, "I'm sorry, you're obviously a restless sort of person, not the sort of person in whom the bank wishes to repose its money. We prefer more solid, permanent citizens, so I'm afraid we must refuse your loan." So I lost my loan. When I got back home, this burning was really quite painful. So I went into the bathroom, stripped off, stuck a large mirror to the ceiling with shaving foam, lay face downwards, and with the aid of my wife's hand mirror, had a sort of periscope effect. And there I saw that on my left... No, on the left side of where a chap normally sits down, this tattooist had tattooed one of his pictures. And that's why I said right at the beginning, this awful indignity, that whenever I have these government forms to fill in for permission to use a handheld water hose in the garden, you know, you get these questions like, subsection S, do you speak Hindustani? Subsection T, have you any distinguishing marks, yes or no? Subsection U, if you have any distinguishing marks, where are they, what colour, and describe them. For the rest of my life, my form will read, you left behind a blue Ken Dodd.
Well, by your vote, Frank Muir just wins the contest of the two stories, and that leads to a final score in which Dennis Power and Frank Muir win by one mark only from Anne Scott James and Dennis Norton. And this also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dilys Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norton, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Schreien and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC. ¶¶